Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Parrot Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest Colin Dickey with us. His latest book is called The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Let me tell you a little bit about Colin. Grew up in San Jose, California, a few miles away from the Winchester Mystery House. That's one of the most haunted houses in America. We'll talk a little bit about that. As a writer, speaker, and academic, he has made a career out of collecting unusual objects and hidden histories from all over the country. He's a regular contributor to the LA Review of Books, co-editor with Joanna Ebenstein of the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. He is also a member of the Order of the Good Death, which is a collection of artists, writers, and death industry professionals interested in improving the Western world's relationship with mortality. He's got a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Southern California, also an associate professor of creative writing at National University. Colin, welcome back. You were on with our colleague Dave Schrader a few years ago. It's good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
And I'm looking forward to this latest book, The Unidentified. That sounds great. Tell me a little bit about the Winchester Mystery House. What makes it so haunted, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah, the Winchester Mystery House. So for people who don't know, Sarah Winchester was the daughter-in-law of the guy who invented the Winchester Rifle Company, and her infant child and then subsequently her husband died at a young age, and so she inherited this vast sum of money, and she, according to legend, she became convinced she was her family was cursed, and a psychic told her that the thing to do would be to buy a house that was never finished. So she bought this 8-room farmhouse in San Jose, California, and started building on it, supposedly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of her life. And so The Winchester Mystery House, which, you know, you can still go visit, still sort of in the heart of, well, actually, I don't know if tours are going on right now, but theoretically, you can visit. It's this 161-room sprawling Victorian mansion that just kind of, you know, it just oozes out in every direction. It's one of the weirdest, coolest houses, and I grew up down the road from it. I used to go there all the time as a kid. It really kind of piqued my interest in these kind of weird spaces and these kind of forgotten destinations that we don't pay too much attention to.
What is it, Colin, about people who love to go to scary places? They just love it. And as you say in the last part of your book title, our obsession with the unexplained.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like for a lot of us, it's just this desire to believe that there's just something more out there. You know, there's something that's just not quite explained by, you know, science or religion or what have you, the kind of stuff that falls between the cracks. It's just, you know, like it's all out there. It's all around us. We don't have a good explanation for it, so we kind of keep coming back. It's kind of like that itch you just kind of can't quite get to, and you keep wanting to scratch it. And I think it just kind of draws us these kind of weird things.
And of course, tell me about the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. What the heck is that?
Yeah. That's a project, you know, my friend Joanna started that I became involved in, and I think it's really just, you know, we tend to think of this stuff as kind of gross, you know, the kind of history, kind of weird medicine, and you know, kind of pathology and stuff like that. But it also has this kind of interesting aesthetic, and it's kind of beautiful at times. And so, you know, Joanna's been really involved in kind of making that kind of historical inquiry into the history of medicine and other kind of weird stuff, kind of her bailiwick. So her and I put together this book that's just sort of a collection of writers kind of tackling, you know, that kind of, you know, historical fascination with medical oddities and stuff like that. So that was a lot of fun.
And where do people get the Unidentified?
It's out as of today. So by the time
great timing.
It's anywhere, Amazon, bookshop.org, anywhere you guys buy books. Yeah, it should be there.
You focus a lot on cryptids, UFOs, lost continents of Atlantis and Lemuria. Tell me about that connection.
Yeah, I mean, I started looking at this stuff kind of, you know, even less like, is it real so much as like, you know, when did we get interested in this? Why did we become interested in this stuff? And it all seemed to coalesce around like the right around the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. You know, the Atlantis, I mean, you know, you got Plato talking about Atlantis, in ancient Greece, but everybody kind of forgets about it until this guy, Ignatius Donnelly, in the 1870s, publishes this book on it. And that kind of reignites our sudden newfound obsession with Atlantis and you know, which continues to last to this day. I think what I started to see when I kind of tried to figure out the kind of historical connection is the second half of the 19th century into the 20th century, that's really when we start to see science and religion kind of polarize into kind of two different ways of looking at the world, these kind of two separate camps, right? And they both have all these answers, right? Both, you know, science and religion kind of, you know, say, you know, we've got all the answers, just, you know, trust us. And meanwhile, you know, there's all this stuff that kind of doesn't get kind of answered by either of them. And I think that's when we kind of start to look for what's going on here. So people who are, you know, starting to look for cryptids, for, you know, Bigfoot and Chupacabra and all that stuff, they were interested, you know, we became interested in this stuff right around the time that, you know, science and religion kind of pretended like they could answer all these questions, and we were left with this kind of weird remainder. And that seemed to be the kind of connecting thread through a lot of the stuff that ended up kind of informing what this book became about.
Have you seen some of the latest videos that the Pentagon has acknowledged now about these UFOs that the Navy fighter jets chased?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, and there, you know, there's you know, reports that the Pentagon was paying, I think they paid like $20 million to some contractor to you know, figure out if there's anything to these videos, which to me is either like, if it's a hoax, then man, that was a waste of money. And if it's real, then man, that's not nearly enough money. I mean, this is the biggest discovery ever. We should be putting a little bit more money into it. So it's a weird number. So yeah, who knows? I mean, I guess we're going to see more, but stay tuned, I guess.
Colin, what got you interested in the unusual?
I think that I've always been interested in that stuff that kind of nobody else wants to touch. You know, my first book was this was a long time ago, but it ended up being a lot about phrenology, which is you know, the science of the bumps on your head and whether or not they indicate your personality. And I thought, well, you know, this is not very good science, but it did really have an impact on the 19th century. You know, it did have an impact on history. And you know, Walt Whitman was a big believer in phrenology, and I realized that just because something is a little strange or off-ball, you know, a little goofball, doesn't mean that it doesn't motivate people to do things and change the world that we live in. So I think I got interested in this stuff because it seems like we should be taking this stuff seriously if it affects our world.
We're going to talk about three individuals from the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, that you key on the first part of your book. Let's start with Ignatius Donnelly. Who was Ignatius Donnelly?
So, yeah, Ignatius Donnelly, one of my favorite guys. He's sort of a failed real estate developer who then goes into Congress. He serves a couple of years in in the U.S. Congress in the 1870s, and then, you know, his political fortunes change, and he's left out. So he decides what he's going to do is he's going to write a book on the history of Atlantis, which, you know, and he's, I mean, you know, Plato notwithstanding, he's kind of the first guy in modern times to really kind of take this seriously. And so he writes this book. It's a huge bestseller. You know, people are just really, really anxious for this. For, you know, it's around the time, this is, you know, right around the time when kind of the Western world has kind of figured out pretty much everything, where everything goes on the map. You know, like, you know, the explorers have pretty much been everywhere. They have kind of filled in the spaces of the map. There's nothing really left to, you know, quote unquote, discover, right? And so when Ignatius Donnelly comes along during this time and he's like, well, maybe there's a whole another continent, you know, and we'll never get there. It kind of triggers that love and obsession and that fascination with, you know, kind of those undiscovered places. And so that's his big kind of contribution. He ends up writing a 1,000-page book about how Shakespeare didn't write the plays attributed to him that doesn't go over quite so well. But, you know, that's the kind of guy he was.
Was he respected during his lifetime?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he was, you know, as I said, I mean, he was a big bestseller. You know, I mean, he got letters from, you know, people like Charles Darwin who are like, well, you know, I don't know that I believe everything, but I think this is a cool idea, and I think you've done good work here. And so, yeah, so he had a pretty far and wide impact. You know, he kind of, in his later life, he could never really replicate that success, and I think he got a little embittered in his later life, but he definitely had his moment to shine, and I mean, we're still talking about Atlantis, and I think that's thanks to our good friend Ignatius.
A name we've heard before, Madame Blavatsky. Tell us about her.
Yeah, and so sort of around the same time, you know, she's pioneering this, you know, this idea of, you know, what becomes theosophy. But she also takes the idea of Atlantis, and then she takes this other idea, Lemuria, which was originally an idea that, you know, maybe there's a continent between Madagascar and India where, you know, which explains why there are lemurs on both of those places. And it sunk a long time ago, and you know, thus the name Lemuria. So she, you know, the geologists kind of lose interest in that idea; kind of doesn't quite work for them. But she picks it up, and she really runs with this idea that, you know, if Atlantis can be somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, maybe there's a Pacific Ocean corollary, Lemuria. And so, you know, like once again, you know, we're sort of looking for kind of new and undiscovered lands, and you know, unlike Ignatius, Blavatsky adds a lot more of a kind of metaphysical dimension. You know, this idea that, like, different descendants or, you know, kind of different evolutions of human beings existed on these various sunken continents, and the Lemurians were slightly advanced from, you know, you and I or whatever, and, you know, they, and so, you know, so that again, this idea that, you know, it's not just a lost continent, but it's a lost continent with these kind of semi-magical or semi-advanced or, you know, creatures kind of floating around. Maybe they're human, maybe they're not, you know, and that then becomes, you know, what people now, you know, talk about in terms of, you know, maybe the soft stars, maybe that's like a different kind of moment of evolution in human beings or something like that. You know, I don't know. Like, I find different theories all over the place.
One of my favorites at the time, Charles Fort, creator of the Fortean Times. Tell us about him.
Yeah, and again, I mean, Charles Fort, you know, who's a huge influence on this book, and I, you know, I imagine for a lot of your listeners. And the difference between Charles Fort, the reason why I think just Charles Fort is so great is that, you know, he, unlike Blavatsky and Lemuria, Ignatius Donnelly, like, he doesn't necessarily put forth a thesis. You know, that's what's really great about those books, is he just sort of, like, he lists all this crazy stuff.
He just lays it out there, doesn't he?
Exactly, yeah. He just kind of puts it out there, and he says, you know, science doesn't have a good answer for this. I don't have a good answer for this, but it looks like it happened. So go do with that what you will. You know, I mean, the idea of, you know, the Book of the Damned, you know, which is what his first book is called, the idea that these are damned facts. These are facts that are kind of cursed and driven out of the respectable halls of science. That to me is a really cool idea. And so what I try to do in this book is best I could kind of follow kind of Charles Fort's model by, you know, kind of you know, reporting and kind of trying to trace this stuff without necessarily feeling like I needed a strong scientific answer for why everything happened.
Colin, how different was Charles Fort from Ripley? They were around the same time period. And Ripley, of course, finding oddities and little crazy things, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's part of a whole movement. I mean, I think that Ford is really the originator of that kind of inquiry because, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners know this, but he starts out writing books closer to, you know, Donnelly's book in Atlantis. He has this book about, you know, maybe human behavior is controlled by, like, radio waves through the planet Venus or something like that, but he can't find a publisher for it. And it never gets published, and he burned the manuscript. We don't have it anymore. We have no idea what was in it. But you know, this idea, you know, so he starts with this idea, like, well, I've got this kind of crazy thesis. But what he actually ends up, you know, being well known for is the opposite, for sort of resisting putting his own ideas in there and just sort of collecting the facts and collecting these reports.
On March 3rd, 1876, large hunks of flesh fell from the sky over Olympia Springs in Bath County, Kentucky. We didn't have airplanes then. What the heck was going on in 1876?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to research was the Great Kentucky Meat Shower. And right, we have these reports. We have this woman and her granddaughter were out outside, and this meat starts falling from the sky. And they collected it up in jars. But
was it human flesh?
So we don't exactly know for sure. There was some analysis that said that it was the closest thing was either horse or human baby.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know. It's really gross. My favorite story, the New York Herald sends a reporter out, and he gets a chunk of this stuff, and he tries to pay an Irish laborer, quote-unquote Irish laborer, that's how he describes him, to eat it. And so he gets this laborer guy, and he's like, I'll pay you to eat this meat. And the guy's like, okay, sure. He gets it on his plate in front of him, and he's like, I really need something to wash it down. So the reporter gets him some whiskey, so, you know, make it a little easier. And,
Jesus.
You know, and then the laborer's like, can I get some vegetables, too? And he, you know, gets him some sides, and then finally the laborer just says, I just remembered that it's Lent. I can't eat meat. And he takes off.
Smart guy. Was it fresh, Colin?
Yeah, it appeared to be fresh. And it's still not. I mean, there are lots of theories about what it was, but I don't know that I buy necessarily any of them. I don't know. What do you think?
And regardless of what it was, how did it come down from the skies? I mean, I don't get it. I mean, you're not flying. You can't drop it from a plane. There is no plane. How did that happen?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the best quote unquote theories is that it was a pack of vultures who were flying overhead and vomited,
and they decided they didn't want it.
Yeah, exactly. They were, they were eating a horse somewhere. Maybe the meat had turned.
That might make sense.
Yeah, but there were no reports of, giant packs of flying vultures. So it sort of makes sense, but it's not perfect. I don't know.
What if a UFO gobbled up some people, did whatever they did to them, and then dumped them?
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. I mean,
you can't rule it out.
Yeah. I heard one theory that maybe they were firing, like, smallpox-tainted meat out of a cannon or something like that, but that doesn't exactly hold a whole lot of water.
What did you do with the University of Transylvania?
Oh, so, right. So I'm trying to figure out. I go out to Bath Springs, Kentucky, where this supposedly happened. Of course, there's not really any traces of it. And then I find out that there is actually, in a jar in the University of Transylvania, supposedly a remaining piece of this meat. So I go to the...
From 1876, it's still there?
Yeah. This weird museum on the University of Transylvania campus called the Monroe Musnick Museum, which they've collected up all these really bizarre kind of historical oddities and medical oddities that the university has stockpiled. It's a really old university. And they have a jar... and it says, kind of an old faded script. It says Olympia Springs, and in it is this kind of, you know, alcohol substance. And inside the alcohol substance is this thing. It's really gross looking. It's like, it's all kind of white and bloated. It doesn't, you know, if you're thinking it's going to look like meat, it doesn't look like meat. It looks like, you know, it looks kind of just like this old bloated white knobby bit of organic matter, you know,
bizarre.
And that supposedly is the last remaining evidence of the Kentucky meat shower. So I went to University of Transylvania to take a look at that stuff.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or a ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Parrot Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.